Hey everybody, welcome to the Uprising Review Podcast. My name is Everett, I'm here with Steven. We are coming to you live from the Mos Eisley Taco Stand, wherever that may be, probably on Mars at this point. We are a few podcasts ahead, so we decided we were going to interview a good friend of ours, John De La Rose. You've seen him writing op-eds for the Uprising Review. He has a new book out called For Steam and Country, which we're going to help him pimp. We're going to shill totally everything, just because he's a good guy, and we really want to help him out. He's been good to us. We're going to be good to him, and we are going to talk a lot about his book. We're going to talk about writing. We're going to talk about conventions and about what it takes to get to a convention. So you know who we are. Let's find out who John is. John, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. And you've been the best shills so far. If you haven't checked out my not only my op-ed, which I did one on at the beginning of Uprising Review, I did two flash fictions for you guys also, one of which was extremely short, and then one of which I did in promotion for Steam and Country, which was a nice little prequel story, which you know, I think turned out pretty good.
I really loved that little prequel. I was really, like, I wanted to get the full experience of reading your book, so I went, and of course, because I right after I published it, I went and I read it. And it really made me want to read the novel. I was like, holy crap, this is awesome. And then, of course, I read the novel.
Yeah, and steampunk isn't really my genre, but I liked that little story, and I downloaded your For Steam and Country, which is something I'm really interested in. I haven't read your Star Run book yet, which is what you're probably best known for. But I'm not really into space opera. So that's kind of where the state of geekdom is today. Science fiction is, there's just so much being produced that it's really hard to keep up with everything. It's like, you know, there's kind of this almost, oh, well, you haven't read X, Y, and Z. Well, now kind of a mindset. And, you know, that's a mindset that's developed over the past 3 or 4 years in the geek community. And it's also developed in the science fiction and fantasy community. And I just think, you know, how can you keep up with things? How can you keep up with every great book that you want to read? How can you keep up with every movie? It's impossible. It's expensive too.
Well, I don't think that's new, actually. I mean, I've been, you know, I've seen the last generation, you know, when I was younger, always saying, well, you haven't read this Heinlein book yet. And it's like, okay, well, you know, I've read 5 Heinlein books. I mean, I get that there's a lot of them, but you know, that's about all I've had time to do, guys. And,
It's like nerd elitism.
Yeah, it definitely is. But you know, I kind of restrict myself genre wise, and that's how I kind of keep up with things. I mean, if I've got a lot of friends who write, obviously, and you know, I prioritize my friends' books because they're my friends. But you know, for the most part, if my friend's doing a vampire book, I'm gonna tell him, you know, hey, I don't like vampire books, and I'm probably not the best person to judge this for you and give you feedback on it. You know, I stick mostly to space opera in my reading, or kind of, you know, more esoteric science fiction stuff, and then steampunk. I don't even like the urban fantasy genre. Anything modern, it's like I can see that on TV, or I can experience it in real life, you know, without the werewolves.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the things that I really am not attracted to in the urban fantasy genre. That and the fact that urban fantasy seems to be overrun with sexy vampires going after this demure little girl who doesn't really know anything about the world. And, you know, it's basically just chick lit in a way. And that doesn't really appeal to me because I'm a guy, obviously. I'd rather have a little action in my books. But yeah, I watched True Blood on HBO years ago when it was like not 2009 or 2010 or something. And I kind of liked it. And then it went super gay. And I was like, no, that black guy Lafayette in the bed with his boyfriend. No. I'd rather look at a bucket of maggots.
I was off True Blood like within like 10 minutes. I don't know even how you got hooked that far.
The main girl Suki is quite attractive, in my opinion.
Oh, that's a valid point.
Yes. But yeah, normally that kind of stuff is not something that I stick to. So I want to ask you, John. You went from writing space opera, which I suppose is something you really must love in order to want to sit down and do it, to writing steampunk. What impelled you to do that? Is it just you wanted to do something unique? Was it you wanted to try your chops elsewhere, or was it because this is on a different publisher? So is this something that you wanted to do for a friend?
It actually, the way I've written things, actually, Star Realms was actually the third novel I wrote. And For Steaming Country was actually the second novel I wrote. The first novel I wrote is actually a different space opera, which I'm working on right now. It was not in near enough shape to where I would show it to anybody. So I say it's my first novel I wrote and I'm working on it now. I've pretty much rewritten it from scratch. I liked my world and I liked my characters, and then I just had to fix it so it's to a level of writing that I like. So that'll be done shortly. So space opera, I would say, is definitely my primary focus. It's been my thing I've been into since I was growing up. It was Deep Space Nine, Babylon 5 on TV when I was a kid. Star Wars, obviously, is the big one. And that continued, through Farscape and Firefly and Andromeda in the early 2000s when those were out. And I thought those were fantastic and actually maybe some of the best. Battlestar Galactica, I watched. It's another sort of space opera deal. I liked the concept and some of the stuff. And so it came from TV, movies, and obviously my reading also. So that is my primary love. Steampunk, what happened was I was at Dragon Con in Atlanta in like 2011. And I was just hanging out, getting drunk at a bar, as people do at Dragon Con. And I saw all these people in steampunk attire going by, basically, you know, with their goggles and top hats and cool Victorian garb and nice, you know, Napoleonic military uniforms that are mixed with, you know, weird gas masks and stuff like that. And I thought, wow, that's some of the coolest costumes I've ever seen. They're so creative and they're unique. What was different about the cosplay is it's their unique expression of what they're trying to do rather than somebody like making a Mystique costume or a Iron Man costume. It's like these are their creations. So I grabbed my wife and we kind of followed them to where they were going. And it turned out they had a steampunk ball and it had like 2,000 people in there, all dressed up like this. And it was just awesome with cool, homemade faux Victorian gadgets and things like that. And I loved it. So what happened was at that point, I just had a little bug in my head and wanted to write some steampunk and wanted to read some steampunk because I thought, okay, well, there's got to be some good fiction out there. And I looked around and there was not that much good fiction out there. And there was a lot of what did you call urban fantasy chick lit, where it's just basically, you know, cosplay porn written out in prose form where it's like describing, you know, every intricacy of somebody's corset. And then she falls in love with a werewolf. And it's like, okay, well, that's not what I was looking for. So I took it upon myself to kind of build a fantasy story that was pretty cool with sort of the steampunk tropes involved in that and try to redefine the genre.
Pretty cool. Pretty admirable. Stephen wrote a preview of it, of the book. He got a hold of a preview of it, as did George. But Stephen, you're going to write up this for Steaming Country for Uprising Review. Do you have any questions for John? Do you have anything you want to sort of pick his brain about without really giving away any spoilers? Because this is, let's just issue the spoiler alert now.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm like definitely afraid that I'm going to accidentally, you know, say something that's going to ruin the book. But no, I actually did end up reviewing it on my website, stephenwillis.co. And that's like the first book review I've ever written. It was a lot of fun, but I'm going to start doing a lot more of them. But, one thing that really, for a little bit of history on this, for the last few years, I've been reading a lot of, you know, politics related books, a lot of, nonfiction, kind of not too super exciting. And, you know, I guess recently I've been trying to get back into, you know, reading, some fiction, but, John's book for me, and I wrote about this in my review, and it probably sounds like I'm like fawning over the book, which I really am, because I think it's great. But it really kind of brought back the excitement for reading for me, in a way. Like, it made me feel like I was like 12 reading a book again. because I'd really been reading a ton of nonfiction. So it's but it's a really fun book. It's what it is. It's just a really fun fantasy. I think it's very familiar. It's not like a and I think one of the really great reviews I read on it. Of course, we shilled for it, and so I kind of read kind of everything that John was posting on it. One of the great, really good early reviews of it was about, you know, how the first part really did mirror Star Wars, but then it branched off from there. And I didn't feel like it was a bad thing. You know, it's something you easily pick up on. It. You definitely, you know, one thing I think you did very, very well is you took the cliche kind of farm, of course, your character's a female, but the little the farm boy cliche, with the missing parent, and you really, you made it familiar. I mean, it was familiar, but you made it unique. And I feel like it's very, very bold to do that. Cause I don't think every writer, I mean, I would be too afraid to do that, to be honest.
Thanks. A lot of the stuff, that people bring up to me, I always kind of go, yeah, that's great. This is actually something I did very intentionally. I looked at the farm boy Luke Skywalker trope, and I thought, okay, I do want to start from that point because it is something that gives you that everyman experience, and I changed it to every girl experience. You know, I made a unique character out of that from that standpoint. But I definitely did want to bring the familiar in. And I drop references left and right in my material. So you'll see some stuff that you'll definitely be like, okay, this is from this TV show, this is from that. I try not to copy it, and that's where you'll get where it changes a bit. So it's like, okay, well, I have this, but I don't want to just redo the generic hero journey of Luke Skywalker, where this person becomes this powerful wizard all of a sudden. I'm going to take it, and I'm going to, you know, kind of have a coming of age where it's a little bit more, I guess, realistic for her skill sets, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's something that I'm kind of interested in because I haven't seen this because I don't watch Vox Day's blog or his dark stream regularly. I do sometimes, but didn't you say that you talked with Vox, and he kind of took you to task for having, you know, sort of a big female character doing empowered female things, right?
Yeah, I think Vox might have taken it a little further than I would have on that. I understand his criticism, at least from his target audience's standpoint. You know, I mean, he's got a group that's very adamant that, you know, women should not be in the military and women should not do this, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I mean, my characters at a point in the novel voice their concerns about that. And it is mentioned in there that, you know, these are extenuating circumstances and these are exceptional individuals who are in there. And, I tried to keep it realistic in that, I guess the real badass female character in there, is somebody who's more of a tactical planner, and she's just got a skill with a pistol, kind of like Annie Oakley's got. So she's not in there as a, like, you know, it's not like a Joss Whedon flick where it's like suddenly this 16-year-old girl is like doing kung fu and kicking the shit out of guys, right? Yeah. It's I tried to look at it from a, you know, creating real women and not a caricature.
Yeah, I think that came across really well in the novel, and I think it's something that a lot of, you know, a review I read on it really mentioned. It was very a real female character, and it was actually, I think I kind of made a joke before the novel came out that I was going to write a review, and it was serious, but, you know, I was going to do it. I didn't feel like it really fit into my review because it was it was kind of personal a review, and it just kind of didn't seem. I was trying to fit it in there. This joke, I guess you call it a joke about how you know you wrote sort of the anti SJW what a real female is instead of, you know, the generic sort of you know, female women power kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, if you want that, I mean, you can look to Talion, who is the, is like I said, the badass in it, and you can kind of get that experience from her, but in some ways, and I, like I said, I didn't go all the way into the generic of what we see in every fiction on that, but I did a different thing of it. But when I looked at Zara, I mean, that's the main character. She's the person who just has just grown up on her own on a farm for 16 years. I mean, obviously she's not going to have a military skill set. She's not going to have a leadership skill set. She's not going to have, you know, she's going to stumble her way into stuff, and she's going to react emotionally because that's what 16-year-olds do. So I tried to create that as realistic as possible. And since I did it in the first person, which I also did intentionally kind of as a writing challenge to myself, you know, I had to dial that in perfectly to where it would not look like a dude writing a chick with tits, or, you know, a dude writing a man with tits, right? which I see so often.
Yeah, you know, I actually did that a while back. I need to try it again, and I really failed at it, at writing in first person as a female. It's definitely something I'd like to revisit, but I think it's something you did really well. And you know, that kind of leads into another thing I really wanted to talk about and ask you about, is, you know, I think a lot of people have recognized that you are very good at writing characters. But what I think a lot of people miss is one of the huge reasons that why you are so great at it is because you are fantastic at writing dialogue. I mean, your dialogue fits the characters so well. Especially, I think probably the best example in Fishman Country would probably be, I feel like it was really, what was her name, Talion?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just fantastic. Just the dialogue matched her character so well, and as well as the best her Zuria's best friend, which was a little more obvious. But I think I just think you're phenomenal at writing dialogue.
Thanks. It was interesting. I was actually sitting at breakfast with a reader who read the book and read. He really liked Star Realms and. Started following me at that point, and he told me that quite the opposite. He said, I really hated the dialogue in this book. And I thought about it, and I'm like, okay, so he really likes Star Realms, but he really hated the dialogue in this book. And I thought, you know what? I think it's because I intentionally wrote characters certain ways that some of them talk with a flair that, you know, feels almost like an 1800 aristocrat, type of character, and that could get annoying to a modern voice. And you know, some kind of have a little bit of a, you know, I would say like her best friend James has a he is kind of a little less educated, and he's just very bright-eyed because he's had an experience growing up that's just been kind of picturesque from a country sense. And so they'll talk like that, and I work very hard on making sure everybody talks like that. And actually I do a pass when I edit, where I go through and I think of just kind of words characters use and phrases characters use and how they talk. And I go through and I specifically go through each scene for just that character. And I do a pass staying in the headspace of just that character. It's a little anal retentive of me, but I think that's why my dialogue ends up having that sort of special shine to it that you were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think, there was a podcast we did, and honestly, this one's probably going to go out before this one, or this one will go out before that one. But there was a podcast we did, and we were sort of talking about dialogue and how, you know, you should really be able to cover up the character. You know, we're talking about screenplays. You know, cover up the character's names and figure out who's talking. And I feel like you could really do that with Forced Human Country because. It just fits them so well, and there was something that I was really impressed with. Now, for Steamin' Country is going to be the first book in a series, right?
Yeah, I said it sort of as this was kind of the origin story of Zara von Monocle, you know, coming into her own, and I want to continue that. I've kind of got a trilogy planned in my head. I've got the second book plotted out right now. So that's where that goes. I've got a couple short stories set in the past where her father, who is a, if for people who don't know, he's kind of a great adventurer, captain of an airship, who's kind of well-renowned all around the world. And so I have a couple short stories that are plotted out featuring him. I mean, I really like the world, so I'm going to use it, you know, until people stop buying it, basically.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a fun world, and it's definitely just a really fun book. I mean, I feel like First Team in the Country is really an awesome, start for that, in much the same way that, Star Wars, the first Star Wars movie was just a really great jumping point where it was just a very, I don't want to say like a popcorn story, but it kind of is in a way. It's just a very fun, story. So I guess my question is, what do you plan to do? I don't want to give anything away, but do you want to kind of take that and make that sort of a jumping point for maybe a more complex story or something like that?
Yeah, the next story, like I said, I've already got it plotted out, so I kind of know what I'm going to do with it. It's going to be a little more complex. There's going to be a lot more digging into, I guess, cultures in this world. And there's multiple cultures because it is a full world. I don't want to talk about it too much other than that, because people probably haven't all read the first book yet. But I've got a deeper story for the next one. This was definitely a just coming of age, get her set on the stage sort of adventure here.
So I'm kind of curious here, John. We just recently really recorded a podcast on age and on the perspective it gives you, and I think your podcast will be out before the podcast on age does, because that one is kind of at the back at this point. And we're trying to bump up the interview podcast to make them a little more timely with book releases. But let me ask you this: what is your opinion on age and writing? Like, would you be able to write for Steaming Country at 20 years old versus at, I guess you're what, about 34, 35 now? Would you be able to write that same story, or do you think that really good writers need to have some perspective on maybe their past or on the past in general before they start writing?
Let's see. I started this one when I was about 30, 31, I guess. And I finished it probably when I was 32, and I set it aside. I mean, I say I wrote this back then, but I mean, I edited it after Star Realms came out. So I did use my experience from that to change this, to make it shine, but the plot itself didn't change. So the plot I came up with and the character I came up with, I'm sorry if I'm talking in completely incoherent sentences right now. What I learned was that, I was writing characters in a way that I was trying to, close my eyes and really picture somebody just normal being thrown into an experience. And while that's cool, you want to have some sort of connecting, grounding reality to them. Most people in their day-to-day lives whine a lot, like really whine. If you listen to people talking, there's a lot of complaining going on. If you just are hanging and you're just watching, especially teenagers, you'll just see so much complaining about how bored they are, how awful this is, how they can't do it, how they, have no self-esteem about themselves and how they hate themselves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because they're going through that transitional time in their lives. Well, that's right. And I dialed that in the first draft. And when I was younger, and in terms of my writing experience too. But what I learned from age is that the audience wants to root for something. And if you have somebody whining too much, if you have somebody complaining too much, in a piece of fiction, that turns the audience off. And so I don't know if this answers the question all that well, because I feel like the plot itself is pretty ageless and pretty timeless. And we've already talked about Star Wars a little bit in this.
Yeah.
But in terms of just how I craft character, my maturity in just dampening down some of the things that I guess I would find irritating as a reader, I wouldn't have been able to do 10 years ago at all.
Okay, cool. So let me ask you this. This is something that we haven't had the opportunity to ask a lot of our guests, and that is something that we are kind of going through right now at Uprising Review is we're doing lists, like lists of our favorite books, lists of this, of that. What would you say are some of, you don't have to have a number on this, I guess, just what are some of the more influential books you read that, and they don't have to be fiction either, but they kind of taught you about writing, the kind of books that you got into, maybe Hero with a Thousand Faces or something, but, you know, maybe the Lajos Egri's Art of Dramatic Writing, something like that. What really influenced you? What, where did you learn to write? What taught you to write?
Well, I mean, obviously there's the Bible, The Art of the Deal, and then Cash by Johnny Cash. I'm totally kidding.
I could tell. It's 1:30 in the morning here, and I was like, is John being serious? Because after a few beers, I tend to think people are serious in Vino Veritas.
I am reading Cash by Johnny Cash right now, and I have read The Art of the Deal and the Bible. That has nothing to do with this. But in terms of actual writing, I think, you know, the focus on character has always been something that I've been interested in reading about. And, you know, Babylon 5 again and Deep Space Nine in the 90s really opened up the world of science fiction TV to where it became character oriented instead of,
Big Ed Monsters.
Yeah. The monster of the week in the rubber suit. Right.
Exactly.
And, that opened up things quite a bit and changed things for better and worse. But, you know, seeing those characters and how they really stood out, impacted me big time. And I think, in terms of books, I mean, I saw the same thing coming out of Lois McMaster Bujold from she does a space opera series through Bane. And I mean, her sense of character is just so off the charts. I mean, I can't gush about it enough. And I don't think I write like her, which is interesting. But she definitely kind of gave me a path of like, you know, what I'm looking for, I guess. Another one is Elizabeth Moon. Elizabeth Moon was nice enough to give me a quote for the cover of the Star Realms book. I think I do very much write like her. She's got just, I guess she's kind of light on the world building, and is very, very intense on the character. So you can definitely, like you're talking about, just looking at dialogue, pick apart who the different characters were there. In all of her books. I mean, I don't even have, because both of these women do series, I don't have a single book that I would point out, but both of their space opera series I would go for. And finally, Anne McCaffrey. I have a strong sense of romance in my books. Even for Seaman Country, it's kind of in the background, but you see it there and it tugs at the characters a little bit. But Anne McCaffrey definitely pushed that into science fiction like few others did, and was able to pull it off where it wasn't chick lit. It was still science fiction that had that in it. So it had a nice balance.
So now, I'm glad you mentioned world building, because I know saw you kind of talking about it on Gab a little bit, and I actually just wrote a book review on one of Philip K. Dick's books that really talked about world building. So, I guess how do you really approach world building? As far as, you know, I mean, you've created an awesome sort of sci-fi, steampunk, fantasy world. You know, how do you, I guess when we've talked about on past podcasts with it as well, is just kind of not putting too much in, you know, how do you know, how to bring in enough detail so that to get the reader really engaged and excited about the world, but not so much that they, you know, are already kind of have a, I guess, too much of an idea. But that's probably not a good way to put it. But
yeah, I understand. I actually, I'm a big outliner, so I come up with my concept. So for Steam and Country, when I sat there, I was like, okay, I am looking at all the steampunk stuff and there's no real fantasy books. There's mostly just romance books, and all of them feature airships that are blimps, and I want an airship that's a propeller. And that's honestly my first thought on this book. I was like, I want an airship that's a propeller, and I'm going to write a book about that. And so once I was doing that, I was like, okay, so here's how my airship's going to fly, and here's how it's going to work out. That starts the world building process a little bit. And then I need a plot, because you can't just have an airship with a propeller. Otherwise, you guys would be very bored for 300 pages. So I come up with my base concept, which is, you know, I want an airship world with propellers, not a big gas blimp thing. And then second, I come up with my plot, which is, you know, I want a farm girl who inherits an airship because her father's gone missing, and she is in charge of this. And we have a nice, kindly that from there. How did she inherit an airship? Because that's a weapon of war. Well, she has to have a nice, kindly king who actually respects personal property rights at that point, which is very unusual for monarchies. And that has all sorts of other implications for the world. So at that point, I kind of like come up with like a few sentences of what I want the plot to do. Then I go back and I develop my character. When I develop my character, some more world detail comes out. And then I go back and rewrite the sentences into a full structured outline. Once I have my outline, I go back and I do a brief history of the world, which details out some technologies and things that are happening and wars that went on and important people, et cetera, et cetera. And usually I get about 6 to 10 pages out of that. And then I just set that aside just so it's in the back of my mind. And then I kind of revise my outline from there. And once I've got my revised outline, then I actually finally start writing. It sounds like a very OCD process, but I think it comes across in how tight my stories end up being.
That is very much the way historians are taught to write history. And I don't know if you studied history at the undergraduate level or graduate level, but that is very much something that historians are taught to do whenever creating. Say you were going to write the history of Ferdinand and Isabella's Spain, or Castilian Spain under Ferdinand and Isabella. You do something very, very similar to that. You would come up with, you know, the beats of the story, because you can look up the history of it. You know exactly what happened. But then you want to develop your own historiography of it. You want to develop your own point of view. You want to say, this is what's important. This is what's not important. This is what led to certain actions. This was kind of irrelevant. It sounds to me like you're writing like a historian would write, which I really appreciate.
Cool. That's totally unintentional on this one, but I like that.
Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know if I think I kind of asked everything I sort of had in mind. I don't know. Let me look at my review real quick. I'm just kind of going through it. No, I think the big thing was just the characters and how, I mean, it's really phenomenal. Cause I really feel like you don't get dialogue that's that in line with the characters too often, honestly.
And really, I think character makes the novel. And I think that if people are going to praise your novel for anything, if it's going to be long-lasting, it will be for character. I mean, the reason people still read Dostoevsky and, you know, Grossman and things like that is for the character. I mean, the reason people read is for character. And I think that there's right now a division in the world of literature between the literary fart-smelling, MFA-having crowd that is essentially writing for 10 people, and the genre crowd that is essentially writing for 200 people in their particular little genre. Actually, it's probably a lot more than that, but I'm just saying 200. But, you know, I think a lot of the quality is actually going on in genre fiction right now. I think a lot of the really good writing is going to go on in the future in genre fiction. And I think as soon as this whole social justice thing, kind of pile on to, you know, like the SFWA, I think once this is cleared out, I think you're going to see another golden age, maybe a platinum age, I guess we could call it, of science fiction and fantasy coming out of it. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm on that same page. I think there's more divisions than that, interestingly enough. I mean, we're getting into subdivisions at this point. But I was actually talking to Jaggi Lamplighter, who's John C. Wright's wife and a great author in her own right. And we both read a book recently that we both enjoyed. And we actually saw kind of the writer's development over the course of the book, where it started out like kind of, you know, it was very much, it felt like my first writing project, where it was a lot of action happened, and, you know, a lot of, you know, racial prejudice starts to happen. And then it really devolves into this message fictiony thing, where it's like somebody really saying, you know, we all need to just get along, guys. You know, which felt very, very juvenile, but of course is hailed as literary by certain crowds. And then what happened was, later in the book, it kind of developed into these characters really flesh themselves out. And that's almost all that happened in the rest of the book. But the rest of the book was brilliant. It didn't have a ton going on. It didn't have the biggest action, you know, 50% forward, and it didn't have all these crazy cool concepts or anything like that, but it did have characters interacting and feeling like deep characters, which was cool. So I kind of agree with you on that. And I think that outside of that literary crowd where it's trying to be message fictiony and everything's supposed to be a metaphor for this or that, you still have a divide where you've got, I mean, I hang with the Pulp Revolution crowd a bit, and I subscribe to a lot of what they say, and they're really into, you know, just doing zany things, over the top things, just for action and just pushing action forward. And a lot of times what I see in some of those works is that they forget character because they're so focused on the action that it comes off almost as dry. Even though it's action, it's dry because the characters aren't reacting to it. It's just events happening. And so that's something to be very careful about. Always make sure to, and that comes out of role-playing also, because in role-playing, we're taught just to do our action and to move on and make sure the action progresses the role-playing game forward. And we don't really share the thoughts of the characters and the internal feelings of the characters so much, because, you know, we wouldn't do that, you know, normally. So I think that aspect of writing comes from that. But I think it's something that some people need to watch out for, because, you know, you really got to add that character color in to make people pay attention to it. And when you do that, the best part about that is if you are light on description of like the airship battles and things like that, or if you're light on, you know, some world building aspects, or say you have a plot point that kind of, you know, is sketchy, people will forgive you that because they are attached to your character and they don't care. And that's the best advice, I think, at the end of the day, is to work hard on character.
Yeah, you know, I feel like that's something you did very intentionally in First Human Country. You know, I really felt like it picked up right where I wanted it to when I was reading it, and it really sat back and relaxed too, just kind of right where I wanted it to, and really developed it was very awesome to read. And I guess, kind of shilling for it a little bit. I really believe it's really got the potential to take sort of steampunk and take that to really, to a lot of mainstream sci-fi and fantasy audiences.
Yeah. And, I am all out of questions. If you have anything else to ask, Stephen, do you?
No, that's all I've got.
John, where can they find you online? Where are you at on Gab? On your website, what, give us your information.
Sure, I'm on Gab as Otomo, Otomo, like the director of the Akira movie. That is the name I stole for Gab. I should probably use my real name because I'm marketing, but I don't care. And
sounds like me.
And then I've got a website. I blog daily, and people read that. I've got about 10,000 visitors a week now, so it's getting up there in terms of popularity on the blog. It's delarose.com.
Damn, send me some popularity. I need to start blogging every day too. God damn it.
Every day. Content creation game is do it every day. If you don't do it every day, it doesn't become a habit for your readers, and that is the biggest thing I got to tell everybody to do. And then I'm on Amazon.
So I guess I will take your advice and just do it every day. But yeah.
My big push, I don't know when this is going to air, but if this does air before July 24th, will it?
I can make that happen.
If it does, I'm really making a big push for Star Realms Rescue Run, my first book, to get nominated for the Dragon Award for Best Military Science Fiction and Fantasy. The Dragon Awards are kind of the I guess alternative to the Hugo, where it's really for more fun fiction that isn't message fiction-y, that's not boring. It's for the new science fiction, and it would raise a ton of awareness and raise my profile big if I can get that nomination. So I'd appreciate anybody who likes that.
Do they have historical categories?
They do. They have alt history category.
Okay.
So there's a lot of categories, but you can vote for just the one if you don't give a crap about anything else. So do vote my Star Realms Rescue Run. That's the one I'm pushing.
Okay. Well, we'll do that.
We'll publish this on the 20th. We'll put the link in the description and on uprisingreview.com.
Awesome. And so, yeah, I don't have anything else to say. I guess we are all tapped out here. It is almost 2 o'clock in the morning where I am, and damn it, I'm still sober. So, we have to go for now, you guys. We've enjoyed listening to John. We've enjoyed talking with you, John, a good friend of the podcast, good friend of the Uprising Review. Anytime you have something you want to publish.
He's basically like a resident, like, professional writer on here.
Yeah, exactly. Anything he writes, we push. That's the way it works, actually. But, you know, I would really like to see us build up a stable of writers that come to us when they have something new, that are kind of in our wheelhouse, people that are kind of like us. And especially, you know, now that we've had certain in-house shakeup take place, you know, John, if you want to submit more op-eds, you're absolutely free to do that. So yeah, anything you want to write, anything you want to help us push, we'd love to. We love you. And follow him on Gab at Otomo. I think that's also the Bird Network is Otomo, isn't that it?
The Bird Network? Oh, no.
Yeah, Twitter.
Yeah, that one. Sorry, no, I am John Delarose on there. I changed my name on there a while back because I thought, oh, well, like I said, I should be promoting myself.
Yeah. But yeah, okay, you guys know where to find him online. You know where to find us online, uprisingreview.com. If you enjoy the podcast, we love hearing from you, podcast@uprisingreview.com. If you want to say something to us, if you want a short story, or if you have a short story and you want to see it reviewed or published, submissions@uprisingreview.com. We are currently taking submissions. That may stop in the future because we are getting quite a few and we are getting a little behind. So if you want your story out there, get it out there now. We do pay a little bit, not much, but we pay you so you can have bragging rights of being a paid author. We also accept op-eds from time to time. Usually we submit them, but if you have a great op-ed, feel free to submit it to us as well. And coming to you from the Mos Eisley Taco Stand, I am Everett for Steven and John. Thank you and good night.